This is the last of five lectures, and so for those of you who haven't heard the other five, it'll be, it should make sense out of context. It's like seeing a mural and looking at a sketch in a corner of a mural, and it can have its own interest. But the mural, the sketch, is actually part of a much more elaborate work, and all the themes interconnect, and it forms really like one large lecture. So it will be, somewhat difficult since I'll be trying to wrap up. I decided to title tonight's lecture Prophecy and Politics. Previously, you remember, I had put on the board the five titles and I'd called it Amos and Pastoral Revitalization. And I decided that I wasn't going to focus exclusively on Amos, but I was going to really be more concerned with the variety of types of prophets. And so I'd focus on Elijah and 1st and 2nd Isaiah and Amos. But I think even considering those four, especially for tonight, I think it's useful to step back and consider the kinds of prophets that we've been considering. The first one that I proposed was with Moses, who was the civilized leader of a nativistic movement, that kind of man who comes from a high civilization and then rejects the qualities of that civilization, knowing full well and understanding it, to affirm a revolutionary underclass. And so I said that this particular kind of individual is often a divided being. And I used as other models, say, Malcolm X, more familiar in American culture, Louis Riel in Canadian culture, who was sort of half French, half Métis, Indian, and led a rebellion of Indians in Manitoba in the 19th century. Patrick Pearse, the Irish revolutionary, who was the first president of the Provisional Irish Republic, whose father was English and his mother was Irish. But also those individuals who aren't necessarily genetically double in their own constitution, but still have mastered the civilized overlord class and rejected and affirmed it, people like Mahatma Gandhi. So that is one kind of prophet, a prophet who's more often really seen as a revolutionary and need not be prophetic. It may be just the Marquis de Lafayette rejecting aristocratic French values and affirming the libertarian ideas of the Enlightenment and the American and French Revolution. The second kind of prophet we saw last week when we're dealing with the ecstatic worker of miracles. And this is the Hebrew school of the Nabim, the Nabi, the ecstatic prophet who goes into an exalted state of consciousness through song or dance. And sometimes it can be wild and Dionysian, like falling to the ground and frothing and singing and screaming, so that when the ecstatic trance touches Saul, he falls to the ground and almost foams at the mouth, and they say, is Saul one of the prophets? So the ecstatic worker of miracles is a kind of school set up presumably by Samuel and continued by Elijah and Elisha. And that is a sort of strong, dynamic kind of prophet who is the actor in history and feels the force of God and does not in any way try to restrain his own actions, or maybe even willing to create a holy war as Elijah is and wipe out the prophets of Baal in a harem, the Hebrew equivalent of a jihad, a holy war. And so that kind of prophet is quintessentially a man of action, not simply the contemplative singer. The later kind of prophet is the literate poet, someone like Amos who writes his sermons, composes them in advance, and then delivers them. So what we have in, say, Isaiah or Amos is a very different kind of consciousness of time and history. It's much more not the worker of miracles, not the kind of supernatural being like Elisha who can make iron float or can raise the dead, but very much an ordinary human being singing out his consternation and rage at the politics of his time and feeling the kind of infusion of divine consciousness. So this is very much Amos and the 1st and 2nd Isaiahs. But though we're dealing with all these different types, the civilized leader of the nativistic movement, the ecstatic worker of miracles, or the literate poet, the artist, artistic prophet, they all have in common the fact that they are not priests, and they all are involved with a denunciation of priestcraft. And so prophecy is to be seen very clearly as diametrically opposed to priestcraft or the priesthood or the Levitical priesthood deriving from Aaron. So that it's very much a battle all through the Old and New Testament of prophet versus priest.
So that all of these, in a sense,
all of these prophets take on the qualities of what we would call the shaman. Now, the shaman has authority, not because of any institutional investiture of power. The shaman has authority because of having survived some overwhelming internal crisis, some transformational initiatic process that has brought him to the edge of his own ego, to the edge of his own insanity and sanity, and seen the relationships between the two, and then somehow or other survive that journey through hell and come out on the other side, knowing the relationships between sanity and insanity in a totally different way from the normal, orthodox, routine, operational shopkeeping or priestcraft kind of personality. So it's very much, it has to be an overwhelming experience. There has to be this kind of thing that we see in the American Plains Indian tradition, where the young boy leaves the community, goes out, fast, endures kind of deprivation, suffering, and then in the midst of that experience, somehow or other, his guardian spirit, his daemon, comes to him and gives him a new name, and he's granted a power vision. There's a very magnificent description of the bestowal of a power vision on a shaman in Black Elk Speaks, and that's very much the American Indian tradition of it. But it's not unique to American Indians at all. It's a kind of universal thing, whether we're talking about the shamanistic experiences in Siberia or some of the shamanistic qualities in a figure like Samuel or Elijah. Now, the priest is just quite the opposite. The priest has power, not authority, by virtue of an institutional investiture in an office. And so he represents what the best people in the best institutions can confer on him. And his only ability to speak for that is in the robes and trappings of office. So he doesn't speak under the wild, intense authority of having survived some overwhelming experience. He speaks for a very civilized experience, something that's taken years and years and years, and finally accumulates in his getting his degree or being having the laying on of hands, and he begins to be the sum of what his culture is all about. His culture in a very civilized, traditional, literate, well-behaved, decorous sort of way. There's nothing wild and savage and Dionysian about the priest. So if you want to think of the conventional categories from Nietzsche, of Apollonian and Dionysian, obviously the shaman or the prophet represents Dionysian energies, and the priest represents the Apollonian, and is trying somehow to institutionalize the ineffable in time and hold it in political control. He's something like a transformer, taking an energy and stepping it down and making it into a domestic current so that everybody in their little huts can somehow run along very smoothly. It's not an attempt to plug individuals directly into the current as Elijah would, or in the yogic traditions of today that we would associate with the Muktananda, who slaps you on the forehead and bam, you go into trance. So when we look at these differences then of the shaman versus the priest, we can say that the prophet is the shaman of politics, and that the politicians and the priests are the mere office holders. In the sociology of Weber, we can say that the prophet is a man of charisma, but the priest and the politician represent the routine operational personality. They're sort of normalcy in all its dimensions, pretty much concerned with society and getting out the daily work and increasing the gross national product and seeing that everything runs smoothly and efficiently. Now, one of the qualities then that separates the prophet from the priest, or the shaman from the politician, is this overwhelming personal transformational experience. And so to understand the prophet, we have to come to terms with this central initiatic Dionysian experience, or what's called the calling of the prophet. Somehow or other, something comes to him and calls him out of his old life and brings him into a new one. So the central question is really, how does the prophet get that way? Now, you'll recall that when I was describing Moses as a nativistic leader and Exodus as the model of revolution, I used from the anthropologist Anthony F.C. Wallace his model of the stages in a revitalization movement, or the stages in a revolution, or the stages in a nativistic movement. If you take those five stages, you can actually apply them to the transformation of the individual, and you can talk about not so much the transformation of a whole culture, but the transformation of an inner personal identity, the transformation of the self. So if we take Wallace's notion again of the maze way, that each of us carries in himself or herself a mapping of space and time that has in this map a kind of implicit sense of values, of what the good is, what the true is, what the beautiful is, and where they are to be experienced in your culture, and how you can wander through this mapping to get where you're supposed to go. Each of us has one of those, and that map constitutes our basic identity. So that if that map begins to be obscured, then we begin to become profoundly lost. So the first state is the steady state, where a person has an identity, and he's either a shepherd or a stockbroker or some sort of normal accepted occupation in life, or just a young person not having gone out into the woods and had the power vision in the way of black elk. And then slowly, out of this steady state, there begins to be an increase in stress. And the stress begins to put pressure on the maze-way or on the modeling of space and time, and so it begins to be pushed out of shape. It's still, in this stage, still functional. The individual basically thinks he knows what he is. If it's a Gauguin, it's basically the individual knows he's a stockbroker, and that's pretty much what it's all about, and there's not yet the sense of becoming an artist. But as the stress between an inner identity and an external need or a social role versus an inner self begins to build up, then the stress reaches the point of crisis where you have identity distortion. Now, sometimes this may come because the individual is not given a choice, then he's just ripped out of life, and you will get a Malcolm X being put into prison. And there in the crucible of the prison, no longer having freedom to move about, compressed into his own self, he has to confront dimensions of himself that he never did before. And so that the prison experience for Malcolm X is a kind of implosion, and out of it explodes a whole new identity. This was very similar for Sri Aurobindo, who was nearly executed by the British for being a revolutionary. And while he was in prison, he began to have mystical experiences and went to higher states of consciousness and went through a whole initiation by which he dropped his identity as a revolutionary against the British Empire and picked up the identity of trying to be a cultural transformer, much more concerned with the entire evolution of consciousness of the human race and not simply one little pitch battle between India and Britain at a particular very local and very specific period of historical time. So the identity distortion is the critical experience. And somehow or other, this crisis, this ability to deal with stress and what happens in the personality is what separates the men from the boys or the prophets from the priests or shopkeepers or whatever. And out of this comes the vision, the conversion experience as it's described in, say, William James's Varieties of Religious Experience, or the calling as it's described by Isaiah or Amos in the Old Testament. What the vision is then is an explosion onto the map of time and space of a whole new interpretation, a whole new explanation of what reality is all about. And the vision contains not only a mapping of the self and all the other dimensions that may have been discovered, but the vision also contains a new mapping of history. So within the case of the burning bush of Moses, it's not simply his encounter with divinity, it's also divinity is announcing itself in time with a new name and saying, go back into Egypt, it is the time of the revolution, let my people go, you must confront Pharaoh. Now, out of this vision, one can begin to speculate, as say Aldous Huxley does in The Doors of Perception, that perhaps the vision is somehow related to the experience of stress, even on a physiological level. And that in things like vision, there is no such thing as a separation between mind and body. I believe it was Whitman who said, and if the soul is not the body, then what is the soul? Or did he say, what is the body? So what you have, in a sense, is Huxley is claiming that as stress builds up and builds up and builds up, it does not, it forces the organism to secrete an enormous amount of adrenaline. But adrenaline is meant to be worked out, like if suddenly a bear comes at you, then you run like hell and you escape the fate. But if you're not running, if you're contained, and the stress is building up and building up and building up, then I believe, as has been described, the adrenaline decays into adrenochrine, which is a kind of psychedelic substance, and so the individual is almost secreting his own LSD in his head. So that there can be, in a sense, a physiological basis to this visionary experience. But you have to be careful not to be reductive. We're not talking about that you can reduce a vision to a physiological substance within the bloodstream, because what is changing the physiological nature of the bloodstream? There's obviously a kind of multiple feedback system going on, so that the simplistic separation between soul and body and trying to interpret one in terms of the other is very naive. We're dealing with a system that's much more complicated, and we tend to slice it in half, but that's because if you have an apple and a knife in your hand and you cut it in half, the violence you're doing to the apple is a description of your own act. It isn't intrinsically part of the structure of the apple. So that there is conceivably something going on that has to do with stress. and has to do with, in a sense, that the prophet has to be an individual who can endure enormous amounts of stress without somehow breaking, so that the stress reaches the point of transformation. And then the prophet has to be, in some sense, a person who can deal with the upheaval of the transformation itself. Now, this is, in a sense, where prophecy becomes very close to lunacy and very close to psychotic states, but is, in a sense, profoundly different from them. Now, one of the things that happens as he goes forth with this new vision and attempts to enact it in time is one of the things that's supremely different from a psychotic and a prophet. With this new vision, the individual interprets the external world and develops maybe perhaps a caricature of it, but an understanding of it, so that in the caricature of saying this is the time of revolution and I must go confront Pharaoh and liberate the Jews, you have a sense that the individual is interpreting history, is trying to adjust himself to it at the same time that he's trying to transform it. So he has to have a very sort of sophisticated understanding. He simply can't withdraw from history into his own fantasies. He's an actor within time and space, and this requires, in a sense, a continual testing of the vision against reality, and it requires a kind of dialectic. Now, Wallace has talked about, and after Wallace, this paper by Wallace was in 1956, so it's earlier than R.D. Lang's work. Wallace talks about the fact that when you take a prophet or any individual who's going through this kind of visionary experience, and for some reason, if they're an embarrassment to the family, they're put in an insane asylum, then you find a strange thing happens. Rather than saying they are the instruments of the Lord, they begin to say, I am the Lord. And they begin to have a complete psychotic break where henceforth there's no testing of the vision against reality, no interacting with the world, but simply the creation of a substitute reality, a fantasy landscape, a totally autistic, psychotic state. So that, in a sense, what Wallace was saying, and that what Lang said more so after him, is that insane asylums drive people crazy. That when you take a person out of a culture and you give him no physical and social medium for realizing his ideas or his fantasies or his dreams and testing them against them, you drive them crazy. It's like taking an astronaut into outer space and then ripping off their spacesuit. They just explode, and they explode and create their own alternate reality. They're very beautiful descriptions of this in Doris Lessing's novel Briefing for a Descent into Hell, with the battle between the two psychiatrists, the sympathetic one and the mechanistic one. So there is something about the interrupted process. If we understood the growth and phenomenology of the self in the way that the Plains Indians do, we would probably encourage this and see that this is the life cycle, this is the life process, and that, to simplify a bit, the visionary experience, the quest, should occur in all normal adolescence in the way that it would in the Plains Indians, and that, as the poet Yeats said, the individual is given a vision of his life work in his teens, and the rest of the life is simply playing out the vision. So there's something that's quite natural about this process, but when we interrupt it, and the language, the visionary mythopoeic language begins to be threatening, then we cut off the process, we institutionalize them, we interfere with the physiology through Thorazine or all kinds of drugs, and suddenly the whole thing begins to go awry, and in a sense it becomes exacerbated and more increasingly psychotic states develop. So that the very process of trying to understand by not sympathetically understanding the healthful nature of vision, but by trying to force people back into a steady state, which is simply the socially accepted consensus definition of reality, the brute common denominator rather than the peak of genius, we interfere with the health of the thing and we drive people into unhealth and we drive them insane. So you have to, in a sense, really understand that there is insanity, but when you're dealing with prophecy and visionary experiences, you're dealing with a new relationship with insanity that is quite different than the relationship of a normal, sane, routine, operational person. Now, there are, in some cases, certain personality traits of the prophet, especially political prophets like Louis Riel or Patrick Pearse, and seems to be also archetypally expressed in Moses. Because of their inner achieved identity, that their identity of who they are and their vision of the Mazeway comes from inside themselves, they can often be very contemptuous of outside, other-directed individuals who are always looking over their shoulders to find out what the crowd is doing and to sort of go with the crowd. So there can be in these kind of lonely, isolated figures who like to see themselves kind of on mountaintops bearing the tablets of the law in their hands, or in the case of Patrick Pearse addressing a multitude of people at a political rally, There's a whole sense that the individual is a loner, his identity comes from himself, and he can only relate to people in really crowd situations. And so there's a strange kind of split in this sort of personality. In supporting company, they can be relaxed, they can be gentle, witty, but in non-supporting company of the unelect, then they have to protect their charisma and their divine gifts. They sort of cover it like a chalice among a kind of alien throng, and they become very rigid, they become full of wrath that can reach almost homicidal proportions, and you see this very clearly in Numbers in the counter-revolutionary purges of Moses, where he asked the sons of Levi to put their swords out and to go through and every man kill his brother and mother's son. And there's just a whole sense of decimating the faithless. So because his identity is forged in the crucible of extreme stress, he expects other people to follow his example and tends to set up a cultural model that is extremely purgative. I mean, think of Mao and the Cultural Revolution. Every time China was becoming a normal, routine, operational society, and they were making atom bombs and rockets, and the gross national product was increasing, and the universities were turning out a lot of technocrats, and everything began to look great, he'd disrupt the whole system and stimulate a counter-revolution and try to create a lot of chaos and go back to this whole sense of stress. So there's a commitment to the transformational process and not the routine operational process. And so the way in which the prophetic figure comes at the historical condition is diametrically opposed to the person who's trying to maintain order and keep things in its proper place. And because his perspective is, in a sense, cosmic, because he more or less sees himself on top of the mountaintop holding the tablets of law in his hands, he sees history as a vast mythopoeic unfolding and always sees the particular historical event not just only as one moment, but sees it as figure against the whole ground of the larger covenant of the Lord or the larger purpose of the revolution. And so there's this continual sense of figure-ground relationships, which in its healthy way can always test reality, but sometimes you can get that kind of prophetic blindness where individuals can see the whole historical landscape but can't see the land under their feet or the particular situation that must be done. And therefore, when the Saul and the Samuel confront one another, then they become very diametrically opposed, and they simply don't see history in the same way. One is trying to affect a piecemeal technological solution to a specific problem, and these politicians tend to be nothing if not problem solvers, whereas the other person is looking at the whole meaning of what the state and evolution of human consciousness is all about. Now, in dealing with the prophet and the relationship between Dionysian or transformational or psychotic experiences, we have to really confront the basic problem of the prophet. Is the prophet simply insane? Now, from his point of view, of course, we could paraphrase Voltaire to say that sanity is the lie commonly agreed upon. Voltaire said history is the lie commonly agreed upon. But if you're in a world of homicidal maniacs in which normalcy is considered to go through a village and lob off everybody's heads and rip open pregnant women's stomachs and bash the babies on the ground, and this is the normal Assyrian way of dealing with politics, then if you have some problems with that, then you're really not adjusted to what reality is like in the 8th century BC. So that when you try to define arithmetically reality by simply consensus and add up what everybody is doing, and that's therefore reality, then the prophet is obviously insane. But sanity is simply the lie commonly agreed upon. To use Plato's metaphor, it's the shadows in the cave, and the prophet is the one who withdraws from the shadows and goes out to confront the sun itself. Now, the usual way that social scientists deal with visionary experiences is to try to reductively put them down and say they're clearly psychotic. Teresa of Avila had something wrong with her brain, was an epileptic. Jesus was an epileptic. Paul was an epileptic. And they just go through history and they just, you know, slice it up in a kind of neat typology. And there are no problems, and they can accept that reality means earning $50,000 a year in an apartment house in Manhattan and buying lots of fancy paintings and calling yourself a psychiatrist, and that's what life is all about. So that when someone challenges that kind of view, then of course the person is psychotic and they don't understand, they aren't really adjusted to the economic facts of the marketplace. Now, if you look at history, there are individuals who have had these prophetic transformational experiences who are not the common typology of prophets or lunatics. They are scientists. The classic example of this is Descartes. Now, Descartes heard dreams, had intense dreams, and heard voices, and felt this strong compulsion to move into silence, to go into his room. He had this kind of visionary quality of staring at the ceiling and being able to see kind of analytic geometry on the ceiling. And he developed a kind of focusing unconscious from the time he was a child. The Jesuits would allow him to sleep late and not take him off into school, and so he would stay in bed every morning and just gaze at the ceiling and project his consciousness onto the ceiling. So that, say, Bernard Shaw talks about in St. Joan that there are certain kind of individuals who have the capacity of seeing their thoughts, so that there is, all of us experience this when we're going down into sleep in the hypnagogic state, and there'll suddenly come a time when you're no longer thinking, and boom, your thoughts become archetypal and visual, and you can sort of read the book in front of you. But the saint figure, according to Bernard Shaw, is an individual who has this capacity in waking state. But it's not simply saints like St. Joan. It's also scientists like Nikola Tesla, who never would use a blueprint, would never have to take notes. He could draw the most complex piece of machinery by just seeing it in his head. So this is a condition of consciousness, something like absolute pitch, or being able to multiply six-digit numbers in your head without pencil and paper. It's something that some individuals have, and if we define normalcy in too tight a way, then of course we exclude them. But Descartes withdrew from society, so he had his separation experience, and then in the isolation he had his whole visionary transformation and reformulated the Maze Way and decided that he, single individual that he was going to take on the whole Holy Roman Catholic Church and the whole structure of human civilization and consciousness accumulated from Aquinas and Aristotle and formulate the whole basis of knowledge for a whole new age. Now, obviously, the guy is demented. He's suffering from delusions of grandeur and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But in the case of Descartes, he did it. One of the reasons he did it is we did not, in a sense, subtract him from culture and incarcerate him in an insane asylum. And so he was able to try and, very difficultly, since he was always brokenhearted that the church would never accept him, play out in time his ideas and try to work with the dialogue of other mathematicians. And basically, he was able to make a fantastic achievement. So that sometimes social scientists are too glib in their reductions of experience, and they forget that people like Newton or like Descartes or Tesla are going through the same phenomenology of growth and transformation that the mystics or the prophets are going through. So what we're talking about with prophets is the creative personality, the one who somehow or other is creatively disobedient and decides to go a different way if everybody's going that way. Now, this quality of judging Descartes after the fact, of course, is the problem we have in historically judging prophets. If you're an Egyptian, you would judge Moses as the maniac. If you're writing history a la the Hebrews in the Old Testament, then you make him the father of your people. So that the question on is the prophet sane or insane often has nothing to do with anything but historical hindsight. And you just go back and you write your hagiography in the way that's appealing for the political purposes of the state. But more interesting, in a sense, is when we're confronting it with the individual going through the life cycle, is the way in which if the process is allowed and not interrupted in the way that it was with Descartes, then the person may walk a very narrow edge between sanity and insanity and redefine the relationships between those in historical time, but somehow or other survives it and comes out sane and comes out, in a sense, healthier by having undergone the initiation. And when that process is interrupted, then you get what Lange calls invalidation, where the insane asylum is a humiliating experience. It invalidates their identity, it destroys them, and forces them to just completely rupture and explode and have a total psychotic break where they say, I am Jesus Christ, I am the Messiah, I am the Virgin Mary. And what the person is doing is saying, I have been so annihilated by everyone about me that I have no sense of my own worth, and therefore I must raise my voice and scream that I am Napoleon, that I am Jesus, or I am the most wonderful person that could conceivably be imagined, because he has no sense of his own worth, because he's not experiencing any kind of validation of human worth or dignity in his relationships with people in the asylum. Nevertheless, we still have to confront, when we're dealing with prophecy, or genius, or creativity, or whatever, that the shadow aspect of this is lunacy, that there is a quality to the paranoid, schizophrenic, cosmic synthesis that is very much a gross caricature of the prophetic synthesis, so that you can see when you're talking to paranoid schizophrenics who have this completely cosmic system of organization, where everything, the sound of a word, the letter, patterns, everything will be enormously structured and organized around the central fact of his own ego, which is threatened, and therefore the ego sits like the czar in the middle of the empire. And so all of these things point to an enormous sense of inflation. But he orchestrates everything in his reality into one grand cosmic synthesis. It's all focused on one idea or one megalomaniac obsession or idée fixe. And there is a quality when one is dealing with the enormous kind of syntheses that we have in a Moses or a Mao or a Descartes, that there is a quality that vision is isomorphic, structurally similar to the paranoid schizophrenic's cosmic synthesis. And so we have a difficulty coming in very glibly and saying, Descartes is sane, but this person is a maniac. You can make the one distinction that I'm saying about the inflation or the confusion, where you go from saying, I am the instrument of the Lord, I am the instrument of history, to saying, I am it. And that seems to be the dividing line. But nevertheless, there's still a great difficulty, and that some of these prophetic personalities are in themselves somewhat mercurial and unstable. So you have to go back to Jesus's advice that by their fruits you shall know them. You have to test, in a sense, the prophetic vision against the reality of history and the reality of politics. And in that sense, the ability of the prophet to relate his visionary scenario to the reality of history and ideas and where everything is perhaps the best description of whether it's just sheer lunacy or it's innovative or creative. Now, if we look at the Old Testament, one of the fascinating things about reading it in kind of succession is that we can see an evolution of prophecy. There isn't one simple kind of prophecy that stays in that way for all time. It's continually changing and evolving for the historical circumstances. When we start out with Samuel, we have the kind of the school of the Nabim, the ecstatics, and we have this whole Dionysian frenzy and almost kind of frothing at the mouth. When we move up from Samuel to a direct inheritor of his school, Elijah, who's definitely in the school of the Nabim, there's a slight, a great transformation or change. Elijah is something like a yogi. We almost see him as the most yogic of all the Old Testament prophets, so that in the autobiography of a yogi, Paramahansa Yogananda quotes his teacher, Lahiri Maharshi, as indicating that he can see all kinds of yogic ideas and powers in Elijah and feels that Elijah reincarnated as John the Baptist and that Elisha reincarnated as Jesus, and that the relationship between the two of them is very clearly, on yogic terms, the relationship of guru and chela, so that when Elisha is chosen by God, not by Elisha, when Elijah throws his mantle on him, he is involved with the power of and shakti of Elijah and takes on all his power. So that if any of you have ever run across Muktananda, you'll know that part of the way he works is the bestowal of his hat or one of his garments or a feather or some kind of direct physical transmission that has his energy or intensity in it. So there's a very yogic quality to Elijah. He also maintains a kind of school of initiates on the top of Mount Carmel. It was supposed to be an Essene school, according to Edgar Cayce. And he developed the kind of the school of Samuel, in a sense, to a new historical force, that there was this ashram on the top of Mount Carmel, and it was keeping night watch over the downhill evolution of Israel into the prophets of Baal. So again, with Elijah, you have a sense that something is going on to the side of time, this phenomenon we encountered with Melchizedek, and that Elijah seems to be a very different kind of figure from even Samuel. And even though he's ecstatic and there is that aspect, he seems to be evolving and moving the teaching in a new direction and much more concerned with the problem of succession. Remember, part of the problem we had with Samuel is that his sons took bribes, and there was no way that we could solve the problem of succession in Samuel. And so we go at it a new way with Elijah, where the successor, the chela, has to be found. And in Elijah's case, God just simply tells him, go and find this man, and he'll be working in the field, and take him and throw your cloak over him. Now, the interesting thing about this aspect of the Essene school in Mount Carmel, in Iamblichus's Life of Pythagoras, he has an incident where Pythagoras is walking down Mount Carmel to the seashore and seems to be like a god and in an exalted state, and climbs on the ship and doesn't eat, and is very quiet and very centered and contemplative, and impresses the sailors, and they carry him to Egypt. So there's this whole sense that Mount Carmel is one of these kind of mysterious Near Eastern Himalayas, and that a lot of the energy and power of Elijah is coming out of that place, or maybe he's even creating the school. So you have a sense that Elijah is very much this kind of order of Melchizedek idea, that there is this kind of tactical force of prophets at the right to the side of time and periodically interacting with the main flow of historical time, and that they're continually revisioning where history is and where it's going. Now, in the God-selected successor of Elisha, you have another continuation of the school of Samuel. There is a situation where Elisha asks for music to be played and so that he can go into trance, and then he begins to prophesy. And so there's a clear way where Elisha describes the use of music and trance as putting himself in a prophetic condition so that he can receive a transmission, to use the kind of Findhorn language. But even Elisha has the same problem of succession. He has a servant, and the chela of a guru in these Old Testament are called servants. So the servant of Moses is Joshua, the servant of Elijah is Elisha. He has a servant, Gehazi, but Gehazi commits the sin of taking money for prophecy. And again, here you have this dividing thing of the mind of the shopkeeper. Well, come on, now let's be serious. You know, we haven't had much money, and here's the thing, and we're doing good work, and what's wrong with turning a little, you know, number on doing good work? It's all the Lord's work, et cetera, et cetera. And so he takes the money, and Elisha just blights him with leprosy and says, you and all your generations will be blighted with leprosy. You will have farms and vineyards and everything, but this curse of leprosy will, you know, carry on down through your generations. So what we see again is the same continuing problem that we've been looking at week after week after week. How do you hold values through time? If Samuel can't pass it on, if only Elijah can find Elisha because God tells him where to go and how to find him, and even Elisha can't pass it on, then how can you hold values through time? And it seems what the Old Testament is saying is you can't in time. You continually have to escape the condition of time to return to the historical moment. And so all of the moments of transformation are intersections of the timeless into time. They are the moment of the interval between each heartbeat. But in the interval between each heartbeat is not linear successive time, but eternity, divinity, whatever you want to call it. So first we have Melchizedek coming in with Abraham, and then we have Moses confronting the burning bush with a new name for God and another radical intersection with time. And then the energy is set up, but the energy flows downhill. And then just as it runs downhill, then wham, another radical intersection at right angles to time, and in comes Elijah with the school of the Essenes on Mount Carmel. And so there has to be, in a sense, a perpetual recreation of culture, a perpetual regeneration of time by the forces that are outside of time, the redemption of time by the timeless. Now, the aspect of succession is fascinating in the case of Elijah and Elisha, because he's been chosen by God, but how is he really going to inherit the mantle of Elijah? And they describe in the Old Testament a very yogic kind of situation. Elijah is walking with Elisha, and Elisha knows that his teacher is going to be taken from him, and he's come somewhat disconsolate at this, and all the other members of the school of the prophets say, don't you know Elijah's going to be leaving? He says, yes, don't talk about it. And so you can imagine that Elisha is mulling it over. How am I possibly going to carry on alone? Once the great heavy guru Elijah is gone, how can I possibly manage? And the whole kind of fear and anxiety and the rest of it. And then he comes up to the point, and Elijah says to him, you've been a really good chela. Is there something I can give you as a parting gift? And he says, yes, and he asks this really radical thing. He's suddenly possessed by a spirit. May a double portion of your spirit descend upon me. And Elijah is shocked. He said, I don't even know if I can grant that. That's a very heavy, heavy thing. And there's this whole sense of asking for a sudden quantum leap in the prophetic succession. And so he tells him, not able to say yes or no, he says, if you can see me leave, then that will happen. And so Elisha watches him. And then as he goes, he says, the chariots of Israel. Well, that's interpreted grossly and concretistically as the fiery chariot, and that a fiery chariot comes down and takes up Elijah. But that's obviously too supernatural and too simplistic and too much of a fairy tale. What's really going on is Elijah is reversing the descent of the soul. Remember that thing I quoted from Gnosticism? As the soul falls in time, it descends through layer and layer of vibration, and as it descends, it takes on a grosser and grosser sheath of energy, different kinds of bodies. So you have the causal body, and then the astral body, and then the etheric body, and finally the physical body. Well, what Elijah is doing, quite simply, is just reversing that and going up energy level by energy level by energy level. And he's saying, if you can watch me as I change modes and not lose me and not lose consciousness as I go from etheric to astral to higher mental to causal and then beyond, then I know you're a true yogi and you inherit the mantle, and now you are going to be my successor. And Elisha is able to do it. Now remember, this is the central test of all yogis, is the ability to watch consciousness and never lose it. Remember the test that Utnapishtim gives to Gilgamesh. He says, watch your mind and don't fall asleep. And the great hero who's been conquering the outside world and is a great extrovert but can't handle introverted experience tries to watch his mind and boom, he's asleep immediately. He can't do a simple thing. But the yogi is the one who can watch the mind go into the hypnagogic state, watch it go into the astral state, watch it go into the out-of-body state, watch it go level by level by level by level. And so that's always the test of experience. The yogi can always give you a very simple physical test to see how far you are by saying, put yourself asleep, do this, do that, and do that. And in the Meninger Institute, you can even wire them up, and you can see whether Swami Rama is in this state or that state, and there are gross correlated brainwave patterns associated with it when Swami Rama stops his heart for 17 seconds or something. So what you have, in a sense, of this is the master going through the ascension of the lokas, and that's the test, because it shows that he has the ability to watch and not lose consciousness and follow the thread of consciousness wherever it takes it. So he becomes the new Elijah and takes up the mantle and then is able to work all these miracles. He can part the water and walk across. He can make iron float. He can raise the dead. And in an announcement, in this beautiful artistic way that the Old Testament works, is he performs a miracle of loaves. There are no fishes in this case, but he makes the meal last. And they said, we can't possibly feed people with these few loaves. He said, yes, you can, and there will be some left over. And so he gives them the bread, blesses it, and then there's an abundance of it. So it's like, again, a Wagnerian leitmotif that's announcing a pattern that's going to be picked up again with Jesus, and is another one of these reasons why the yogis, not just the yogis, the Steinerites and the Gnostics, talk about this reincarnational pattern of Elijah becoming John the Baptist and Elisha becoming Jesus. In Matthew 17, it says, and his disciples asked him, saying, why then say the scribes that Elijah must first come? And Jesus answered and said unto them, Elijah truly shall first come and restore all things. But I say unto you that Elijah is come already, and they knew him not, but have done unto him whatsoever they listed. Likewise shall also the Son of Man suffer them. Then the disciples understood that he spake to them of John the Baptist. And so it's even in the New Testament itself. Reincarnation was in patristic Christianity, and I think it went out with the official priestcraft getting together, and I think the Council of Nicaea deciding that that was not the theology for Christianity, and so it was kicked off into Buddhism and Pythagorean metempsychosis. So now you can see, in a sense, that Elijah picks up the mantle, is the miracle worker, and is very much involved with the harem and trying to wipe out the prophets of Baal, as Elijah does. And he's not quite the showman that Elijah is, where Elijah's comes to the situation where he says, all right, if you prophets of Baal are so great, have your God light the fire. And so they're praying and chanting all day and nothing is happening. And so he says, okay, it's my turn. And he says, all right, dig it, soak the fire. Soak it again, soak it again, soak it again with water to make sure that, you know, no casual spark could do it. And then he goes, boom, the thing goes up in flame. But then the interesting thing that happens after that is then he tells the people, all right, now take up your swords and wipe out every single prophet of Baal. I mean, this is a really heavy guy. This is a jihad of the most intense form. And so Elijah is very much the actor in history. He's, again, continuing that mosaic pattern. And this also is very much the pattern of Elisha, not quite as strongly as before. But what you have, in a sense, with these patterns that I'm describing is the way in which myth is working. Notice how all along in these lectures I've been continually talking about the Old Testament as if it were a Wagnerian music drama, and all of these things are echoing other things. So Elijah raises the dead, and that looks forward to Jesus, cures lepers, and that looks forward to Jesus, makes a miracle of loaves, and that looks forward to the miracle of loaves and fishes. So there's a sense that this pattern is very much consummated with Jesus, so that when he is going into Jerusalem, Jesus is very intent on satisfying patterns, and that you have to move through time as if history is the performance of myth, and therefore there's an exquisite dance to it all, because only in that way can you bring in past and future to impregnate the present with the richness of the fullness of time. The ordinary man just sees it, what's in front of his nose. But Jesus as a revolutionary is much more complicated than that. And Jesus, when he found a young ass, sat thereon, as it is written, "Fear not, daughter of Zion, behold, the king cometh sitting on an ass's colt." These things understood not his disciples at the first. But when Jesus was glorified, then they remembered that these things were written of him, and that they had done these things unto him. So even the disciples don't understand what's going on at the time. They're only seeing a small pattern and have this microscopic blindness. But Jesus is enacting a pattern that is consciously echoing myth. Let's see if I can find the quote that he's involved in. It's from Zechariah. Zechariah. "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding upon an ass, and upon a colt the foal of an ass." So the central dramatic moment in which Jesus is to return to Jerusalem as Melchizedek once went out of Jerusalem to meet Abraham is now very much in the case of humility and riding upon the donkey. So what you have then is politics seen mythopoeically. Politics played not so much as the art of the possible, as politics has always been decided upon, but politics as the intersection of miracle, or politics as the art of the impossible, and that's of course revolutionary politics rather than just continuing a tradition. If history is the performance of myth, in the way that Jesus is performing the myth there, then the prophet is the man who sets the contemporary political condition against the ancient religio-mythic context. He is the one who has the larger view of what it's all about and can see this figure event against the ground of being of the whole unfoldment of Hebrew history or the evolution of the race. So you always have, in a sense, a political condition seen very narrowly and then the mythic backdrop for that. So it's Elijah versus Ahab and the backdrop of the divided monarchy of Israel and Judah. Or it's Amos versus Jeroboam II, which was a kind of period of temporary wealth and intense Phoenician consumer society right before an incredible sequence of assassination, civil strife, and the eventual Assyrian conquest of Israel in 721. Now what you have in these backdrops to the political event, the mythic backdrop to the political event, is a pattern again. It's that Solomonic pattern that material success is spiritual failure. That right when the Hebrews think they're at the pinnacle of their achievement, they have forgotten that Solomon has just become another Pharaoh, and Pharaoh is what Moses was trying to get away from, and so what's happened to the covenant of the Lord? So it creates this kind of paradox that success in the world is failure spiritually, and that failure in the world is somehow necessary for one's charismatic investiture. And so often in cases of artists or prophetic figures, that failure is an enormous part of the makeup of their personality. And so I was talking very much about a couple of weeks ago about the pattern that Peter Virik talks about in Metapolitics, that many of the SS romantic politicians in Hitler's Germany were failed artists. And so he has a chapter called The Revolutionary as Artist Manqué. You can see this pattern in going on in, say, Gopi Krishna, if you've read Gopi Krishna's autobiography, where this kind of kundalini transformational experience is still very much based on the failure to satisfy his mother, the failure to graduate from college, the failure to be a poet, and suddenly comes the inflationary experience, and now he's the sage of the new age, and he's able to redeem his own failures. Nevertheless, failure is still the fundament for it. So you have, in a sense, what the Old Testament is saying is that success is a trap, and that false prophets will appease the successful. True prophets anger the rich. True prophets insist that material success is deadly, and that right when everybody is feeling comfortable, they come in to make them feel uncomfortable. Now, the classic example, of course, of this moving up in historical sequence is Amos. Amos is the shepherd, and here again you reach this pattern where Muhammad said, "Let no man be a prophet who has not been a shepherd." And so it's very much the classic battle of the shepherd versus the city. It's the nomadic, the pastoral, the unsettled way of life without intense class division, without accumulation of wealth, and very much the landscape of the stars and the desert where the shepherd can remember of the covenant of Abraham. And so Amos begins to be the shepherd who is called out by God to go forth and to prophesy in Israel. Now, what was going on in the historical backdrop of Amos's time with Jeroboam II is there was a new wealth of accumulation where the Hebrews were beginning to be very civilized. They were taking on the ways of the Phoenicians. They had established really a very sophisticated world trade. Their architecture was much more civilized in Israel than in Judah, which stayed fairly simple and tribal. And there wasn't the pronounced division between rich and poor in the south in Judah that there was in Israel. So Israel was sort of really making it, sort of looking down upon the south in the way, say, the industrial north would look down upon the rednecks and primitives in the south before the south began to go the way of the north. So that you have very much the sense that now the tribe is broken up and there are rich Jews and poor Jews. And so now it isn't a question of just the Hebrews against Pharaoh, it's the Hebrews against the Hebrews. And so now there are the Pharaonic Hebrews and there are the Mosaic Hebrews. So Amos comes to excoriate and to attack and introduce a new note into historical consciousness. Amos isn't simply talking about the covenant of the Lord. He introduces a new language. He begins talking about the poor. And in this sense, he's raising historical consciousness to a whole new level. Thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Israel and for four, I will not turn away the punishment. Because they sold the righteous for silver and the poor for a pair of shoes, that pant after the dust of the earth on the head of the poor, and turn aside the way of the meek, and a man and his father will go in unto the same maiden to profane my holy name. And they lay themselves down upon clothes, lay the pledge by every altar, and they drink the wine of the condemned in the house of their God. And so it's very much, the language is again wealth and selling the needy for a pair of shoes, and a whole sense that this is contemptible, this is forgetting tribal unity. So the shepherd remembers that they are the people of Abraham, and the other people have forgotten, yeah, he used to be my brother, but you know, business is business, so let's make a buck off him, and if you can screw him, it doesn't matter. And the prophet comes in and says, to hell with business, to hell with success. Now, Amos is a very paradoxical fellow. He's basically a literate shepherd. Now, in the old days, the attack on civilization would have to be the attack on writing. But now it's begun to be that the characteristic of civilization is going to be used against itself. Amos will compose his sermons in advance, write them, and then deliver them on a kind of appropriate occasion. This is not the ecstatic prophetic tradition of Samuel. And nevertheless, it's setting a foundation for a pattern that's going to be the poet as prophet that will carry on all through Europe. So whether you get Virgil or Spencer or Milton, you have the prophetic artist, or Lawrence, is a man who uses civilization, writing, against civilization itself, technology. And so the threat of civilization, meaning wealth and accumulation and writing and standing armies, is now shifted. So you take again the enemies of the overlord to use against them. Technically, the shepherd should be involved with oral culture and should have nothing to do with writing. Now, the literate shepherd is therefore a kind of new dialectical attempt to resolve the profane social contradictions into sacred numinous images, the shepherd as prophet. The poet shepherd is outside the city, in the sense that Genesis has been attacking the cities all along, and he is the equivalent of the shepherd king within the city. If you're dealing with the contradiction between tribe and civilization, then you try to resolve it in the way that David did by being the lowly, primitive shepherd king. And shepherd king becomes an oxymoron that is trying to resolve the contradictions. In the same way, the literate shepherd, the poet prophet, is a way of trying to resolve the contradictions in the collision between tribe and civilization. So what you have in Amos is very much a rejection of everything that is civilized, that is sophisticated. For they know not to do right, saith the Lord, who store up violence and robbery in their palaces. And so you get this whole, again, the language of the condemnation of the rich. Therefore, saith the Lord, an adversary there shall be even round about the land, and he shall bring down the strength from thee, and thy palaces shall be spoiled. Hear ye and testify in the house of Jacob, saith the Lord God of hosts, that in that day I shall visit the transgressions of Israel upon him, and I will also visit the altars of Bethel, and the horns of the altar shall be cut off and fall to the ground. And I will smite the winter house with the summer house. You see, here we are. It's very clear in this Phoenicia of the time that they've reached the level of the Hamptons, and there's the Manhattan townhouse, and there's the Southampton summer place, and he's going to smite Southampton with the east side. and it's very clear that this is a renunciation of civilization in all that it means. I will smite the winter house with the summer house, and the houses of ivory shall perish, and the great houses shall have an end, saith the Lord. And here it begins to be something that occurs in Isaiah as well, is the absolute contemptuous rejection of priesthood and all the sense that somehow or other priestcraft is divine management, and if you know the proper ritual and you know how to manipulate everything, you can keep the Lord in his place, which is your temple, which you run, and you can keep society in its place because you become the intermediary, because you've got a corner on the market for God. I hate, I despise your feast days, and I will not smell in your solemn assemblies. Though ye offer me burnt offerings and your meat offerings, I will not accept them. Neither will I regard the peace offerings of your fat beasts. Take thou away from me the noise of thy songs, for I will not hear the melody of thy viols. But let judgment run down as waters, and righteousness as the mighty stream. So there's a whole kind of radical anarchist, decentralist point of view. If you can take your ritual and music and song and all the luxury that David tried to put into Solomon's temple and be done with it, because it's basically idolatry. So what he's doing, in a sense, is rejecting urbanity, civilization, and the better people. And so he's totally at war with everything that any decent, civilized human being would consider the facts of life and the pressure of reality. Woe to them that are at ease in Zion and trust in the mountain of Samaria, which are named chief of the nations, to whom the house of Israel came. Ye that put far away the evil day and cause the seat of violence to come near, that lie upon beds of ivory and stretch themselves upon their couches, and eat the lambs out of the flock and the calves out of the midst of the stall, that chant to the sound of the viol and invent to themselves instruments of music like David, that drink wine in bowls and anoint themselves with the chief ointments, but they are not grieved in the affliction of Joseph. Therefore now shall they go captive with the first that go captive, and the banquet of them that stretch themselves shall be removed. The Lord hath sworn by himself, saith the Lord, the God of hosts, I abhor the excellency of Jacob and hate his palaces, therefore will I deliver up the city with all that is in them. And so again, the rejection of the city, the rejection of urbanization, the emphasis upon the tribe. So this is pastoral revitalization, where you go back in the nativistic movement to affirm pre-civilized values. Then Amaziah, the priest of Bethel, and here comes the priest trying to confront the shepherd, sent to Jeroboam, king of Israel, saying, Amos hath conspired against thee in the midst of the house of Israel. The land is not able to bear all his words. For thus Amos saith, Jeroboam shall die by the sword, and Israel shall surely be led away captive out of their own land. Also Amaziah said unto Amos, O thou seer, go flee thee away into the land of Judah. He's saying, go down with the rednecks and the hicks. Go down there in the south where they don't have really sophisticated, wealthy people like we have. You can be a slob and a shepherd down there and nobody will know, and you won't be able to tell you from anybody else. But this is civilization, and you just can't do that in New York, buddy. But prophesy not again any more at Bethel, for it is the king's chapel and it is the king's court. And so here again, you have centralization, the capital, and the whole problem of tribe versus civilization. Now with Amos, as he's confronted by the priest, he again affirms the fact that he says, I am no prophet, but was a shepherd, and was a tender of sheep and a gatherer of sycamores, but the Lord called me and said to prophesy in Israel. So he has the whole sense that what separates him as priest and prophet confront one another is this ineffable event, this indescribable event. And so Amos confronting the high priest is very much like Caiaphas confronting Jesus, or Pharaoh confronting Moses. But now it's within the culture of Israel itself, because Israel has become split and has become the two nations of the rich and the poor. So again, we have this archetypal pattern of prophet versus politician, of prophet versus priest, or culture in the traditional pre-civilized sense of culture against technology and against progress and the GNP and all of that. So it's Amos against Jeroboam II. It's Elisha against the sons of Ahab. It's Elijah versus Ahab and Jezebel. It's Nathan against David, Samuel against Saul, Moses against Pharaoh, or Jesus against Caiaphas and Pontius Pilate. Now what you have in these confrontations of the dialectic, of course, is a tragedy in the sense that life is being cut in half and the confrontations are violent. And that's basically a condition of the tragic nature of human consciousness. Urban prosperity makes man forget the past and the future and simplify everything to the pressures of the moment, of just making a job and getting ahead. Hence, only suffering can bring people to their senses. And so the prophet begins to be the one who emphasizes the aspect that redemption can only come through suffering, that suffering versus success is what really life is all about. If you recall back when I read the section in 1 Kings about the temple that Solomon is building, they go on for page after page of saying the candlesticks are of gold, the cherubim is of gold, the door is of gold, this is of bronze, and there's just this long, long catalog of how they've got the best that everybody could afford. But the language of that, which is the language of success, is so materialistic and the poetry is so ghastly that it should be seen in dramatic distinction between, say, the language of 2nd Isaiah. Comfort ye, my people, saith your God. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem, and cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she hath received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. So here's, in a sense, the whole tragic consciousness of the suffering, and only the fact that through suffering, the poetic level of the Bible goes to another level of excellence, and that when they're dealing with material prosperity and success with Solomon, the level of prophecy is at its nadir. The voice said, cry, and he said, what shall I cry? All flesh is grass, and all the goodliness thereof is as the flower of the field. The grass withereth, the flower fadeth, because the Spirit of the Lord bloweth upon it. Surely the people is grass. The grass withereth, the flower fadeth, but the word of the God shall stand forever. So what you have in the second Isaiah, dealing with the Jews in the Babylonian captivity, is a consciousness that's forged in the crucible of suffering. And what happens is a new human tone. Note that second Isaiah can't work miracles. He's not an Elisha, he's not an Elijah, he's not even a Samuel. And so as you're seeing the evolution of prophecy, you're seeing it move to increasingly human levels, where the prophet begins to be not the heavy miracle worker or the magician or the sage, but simply the artist who can speak out of his own human suffering and make his suffering sing for all mankind. And this is a tremendous evolution from what the prophetic conditions had been before. Elijah was definitely the divine actor in history, and so he instigated the harem against the priests of Baal. The first Isaiah rejects priestcraft just like Amos, and says, I don't want to smell your fatted calves. I have no use for any of that. Take away your incense. But the first Isaiah is not an actor in history, but sees history itself being used as an instrument by God. And so Elijah may kill the prophets of Baal with the help of the people, but first Isaiah will look at the Assyrians and say, and in the voice of God, the Assyrians, they are my instrument. I will chastise the people with the Assyrians. And so there's an interpretation of the politics of the day. And one should realize this is like reading the New York Times and then somehow or other reinterpreting it mythopoeically. Assyria seems to be really legendary and hallowed by time and almost seems a myth when we read the Old Testament. But we have to remember what Isaiah is doing is he's taking politics and interpreting it in a mythopoeic way, but not with all the miracles and the powers of Elijah and Elisha. So he sees God as the historical agent. The second Isaiah is the voice of redemption through failure and suffering. And of course, this is probably one of the ways in which the poetry in second Isaiah is the most sublime, at least I think, in the whole Old Testament. Interestingly enough, with second Isaiah, this is a period of prophetic explosion all over the world, because it's not only the time of second Isaiah, but it's the time of Pythagoras, it's the time of Zoroaster, of Buddha, of Mahavira, the creator of the Jain religion, and of Lao Tzu in China. So all the way from Greece to China, there was a simultaneous explosion of individuals who were trying to deal with the contradictions of civilization, this mammoth split between the rich and the poor, and this mammoth militarization of the world by which Egypt and Assyria were defining reality in terms of so many stockpiles of heads and human sacrifice and the rest. So the interesting aspect is that somehow or other the historical clock is coming up with a universal contradiction, and a universal civilization is beginning to emerge in the prophetic revisioning of the landscape. So that as the Jews are returning from the concentration camps of Babylon, then they begin to express a tragic but epic and magnificent consciousness. Now there are interesting aspects in the way in which prophet and priest fight it out, sometimes in the same text where the priest will intercede and put in his own words, as we saw very much in Genesis. That Isaiah will be talking about the way in which now in the universal religion, that the house of God shall be a house for all mankind, and that no longer will it be just simply for the Jews or for the circumcised. But in the words of the priest, the language almost contradicts Isaiah, and it says, "Awake, awake, put on thy strength, O Zion, put on thy beautiful garment, O Jerusalem, the holy city, for henceforth there shall be no more come unto thee the uncircumcised and the unclean." And then just a few pages away, "Neither let the son of the stranger that has joined himself to the Lord speak, saying, the Lord hath utterly separated me from his people." And so he say, don't let the stranger say, I'm a Gentile and an outcast. And he's beginning to say, this is a universal religion, not tribal. It's a revisioning of the whole moral basis of what culture is all about. "For mine house shall be called a house of prayer for all people." So this is really a radical sense that at the same time that civilization, which had started with whatever brilliance in the fourth millennium, has gone downhill, and nothing is left around the 6th century B.C. but the dregs of Egypt and the dregs of Mesopotamia and Assyrian militarism. And it's right at that point that all over the world there's an explosion of prophecy and the creation of what can be called not tribal religion, but universal religion. Now notice Amos, as opposed to 2nd Isaiah, is still very much of a nativist. He's rejecting civilization and its discontents. But 2nd Isaiah is coming in and speaking because the people are not successful and they are in the concentration camps of Babylon. He's speaking for the oppressed and therefore can join with them and raise his horizons to a much more global level. And so this is a tremendous evolution of prophecy again as you move from tribal rejection of civilization to universal prophetic affirmation of the brotherhood of mankind and the creation of what can be called the first universal religion, preparing for the incarnation. Interestingly enough, in the interjection of the priest in Isaiah's language, he calls it the holy city of Jerusalem. Now, cities have been cursed all through the Bible. Cities are Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities founded by Cain. Finally, after the purgation of the Babylonian captivity, now that Jerusalem is in ruins, as they're going out of Babylon and going back after the edict of Cyrus to build the city, then the holy city can be on the horizon and a city can be holy. Once you move into the city and you take up rent and you open the shop and you begin to worry about the price of bread and olive oil, then your horizons collapse again, and then sure enough the prophets are going to have to attack, and finally you will get the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. So the holy city is another one of these oxymorons, these mutually contradictory terms like shepherd king or shepherd literate poet. Genesis cursed the cities, and yet Melchizedek came out as king of Jerusalem, announcing that Jerusalem was going to be the central action in this manifold pattern of history that was going to go through Old and New Testament. The Rechabites, who were a kind of nativistic movement that rejected civilization, had nothing to do even with agriculture, and they said the whole basis of agriculture was foul and that nomadism was the only proper biblical way to live. So what you have in the battle between, say, the Solomons and the Abrahams is the thesis nomadism, that values can only be held by moving, that if you settle down, you're going to forget. So you've got to continually move and move and move and never accumulate goods. If you've read the Book of the Hopi, you'll know that's the thesis of the Hopi, that those tribes who in their wandering settled down and accumulated wealth failed, lost the vision. So nomadism is moral, civilization is immoral. So thesis, nomadism. Antithesis, urbanism. Synthesis, the holy city of Jerusalem. The attempt to reconcile. But it can only reconcile it as long as you're not living in it, as long as it's on the horizon and you're in a condition of suffering. Once you move in, then you're in trouble. So Jerusalem again begins to be this archetypal city that goes throughout the Bible all the way into Old and New Testament. The Jerusalem of Melchizedek, the Jerusalem of 2nd Isaiah, the Jerusalem of Jesus, and looking forth to the New Jerusalem of, say, John, when the New Jerusalem shall descend out of the sky. If man tries to build his cities upward, he creates the Tower of Babel. The only way a city can be built and still be moral is if God builds it and it descends out of the heaven. So the way in which this myth and this pattern continues through history is shown in the New Testament. And I want to close with the New Testament showing the evolution of the prophetic consciousness through time by means by which the Bible affirms that always to the side of time there is the ineffable, the inexpressible, the mysterious, the strange order of Melchizedek, the Essene order of Elijah on Mount Carmel, and that always as history is moving and forgetting, at radical moments there will be right angle intersections with the historical thing that will shatter it and startle it to a whole new consciousness. If I can find the right section. And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. Again, this pattern of showing off, boy, we've really got a nice temple. So this is echoing back to Solomon again. And Jesus said unto them, see ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And so he's prophesying the destruction of the temple, which will happen in 70 AD. And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, where David went up to weep, so another pattern, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? And Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no man deceive you. The central problem of prophecy, of course, is how do you tell the lunatics from the genuine? How do you deal with this edge between psychosis and prophecy? Take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places. All these are the beginning of the sorrows. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another. And many false prophets shall rise, and shall deceive many. And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. But he that shall endure to the end, the same shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then the end shall come. When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation, which is referring to Daniel's prophecy about the end of the world, Daniel is another kind of prophet, who is very much like the Zoroastrian mage. So again, you have this paradox that the Hebrews are captured, put into the Babylonian captivity, confront their overlord's culture, absorb from them and transform it into their own traditions, so the Chaldeans begin to inform and impregnate the prophetic traditions of the Hebrews in the way that Moses was affected by the Egyptian traditions. So again, you see this constant dialectic, this double helix between tribe and civilization. When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place. Whoso readeth this, let him understand. So there's this whole kind of mystery going on here. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house, neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. And woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. But pray ye that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day, so that you can really run, because you're going to have to run. For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should be no flesh saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. Then if any man shall say unto you, lo, here is the Christ, there or there, believe it not. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, inasmuch as if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect, not just the Slavs, but the very elect. Behold, I have told you before. Wherefore, if they shall say unto you, behold, he is in the desert, go not forth. Behold, he is in the secret chambers, believe it not. For as the lightning cometh out of the east, and shineth even unto the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles gather together. Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heaven shall be shaken. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Now learn a parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender, and putteth forth leaves, ye know that summer is nigh. So likewise ye, when ye shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass, which I interpret as the Magnus Anus of the 2,000-year cycle that I've described before. This generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away. But of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark. And knew not until the flood came and took them away, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. Then shall two be in the field, then one shall be taken and the other left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill, the one shall be taken and the other left. Watch therefore, for ye know not what hour your Lord doth come. But know this, that if the good man of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched and would not have suffered his house to be broken up. Therefore be ye ready, for in such an hour as ye think not, the Son of Man cometh. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom his Lord hath made rule over his household to give them meat in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find him doing. Verily I say unto you, that he shall make him ruler over all his goods. But if that evil servant shall say in his heart, My Lord delayeth his coming, and shall begin to smite his fellow servants, and to eat and to drink with the drunken, the Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looketh not for him, and in an hour that he is not aware of, and shall cut him asunder, and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. So the central pattern is that Jesus is playing on all the patterns of the Old Testament and basically dealing with the mythopoeic fact that the servant who forgets and says, well, he's not going to be coming back, I've got time, let's just go back to business, and confronts the time seen only as the moment, absolutely destroys the fullness of time. The other one who remembers both the past and recalls the future understands that past and future interpenetrate one another in a relativistic way, and somehow this particular action looks back to Melchizedek, looks forward to Jerusalem, and looks forward again to the end of time. So that the nature of time in the unconscious is that it's not linear and discrete. And so when Bosch is seeing the end of the Middle Ages and prophesying the future, he sees machines in the air dropping fire under the cities. And so painting the painting in 1500, he sees the end of the whole medieval world and the emergence of what is going to become the modern world system. But he describes it in a way so that the collapse of the world in 1500 is seen in a parallel way with the collapse of the world in the year 2000. And so there's a telescoping of time, because in this relativistic way, the future and the past impregnate the present. And the particular impregnation of the present is the prophetic act. So why don't we take a tea break? That was long. Wow. Oh, yeah. Yes.
The allusion to Jerusalem as a synthesis between civilization and the tribal world, but yet one mustn't let Jerusalem be too permanent. Makes me think that maybe Lindisfarne has a future simply because you're moving out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's very conscious.
Compare it with Findhorn, which may be getting to become too much of the holy city.
Well, except it keeps changing too, in the sense that it's one thing, and then it becomes it's seven people, then it becomes a community, then it has Clooney, and it goes through these different patterns of change. But the yes, there's definitely that aspect of renewal through change and continuity requires some form of death and release, and that the consecration of Jerusalem only comes in its destruction. It's only when it's in ruins on the horizon, when they're in the Babylonian captivity, that it really becomes sacred. Up to that time, it had been the city of taxation, the city of the king, the city of the chariots, the city of the military, the city set up by David not to be tribal, but to do an end run around the tribes by setting up this place in the middle that wouldn't relate to any of the strong tribes. So the whole notion of the holy city of Jerusalem that we think is a very late and very radical notion that just doesn't come up earlier in 1 Kings. But the basic notion that you're pointing to is, life means release, and that if values can't be held in time, then they have to be danced. And so you can't hold on to anything, because just as soon as you're holding on to your adolescence, while you're moving into your 20s, so the whole rhythm of life seems to be the denial of permanence. And the only way to really maintain a permanent value is by continually surrendering it and allowing itself to flow in whatever way. So it requires release. Institutionalization means staying put, setting, and the rest of it. Peter's notion of Findhorn is that they're supposed to be building an ark, and that for the chaos of Britain and all the rest of it, it's got to be bigger, where Lindisfarne was never intended to be big, you know, and will conceivably never be big. So they have a different purpose over there.
Similarities or differences between the historical woman and the time of Second Isaiah when the other cool religions were coming out?
Yeah, I think they're analogous. That I think we're in an age of prophetic dispensation where all the world's religions are being energized at their vanishing, that we're moving into a post-religious sacred way of life, and therefore all the great universal religions are going into their sunset, and so we're seeing the explosion of Hinduism and Sufism and Tibetan Buddhism and Zen Buddhism and all of these things. But I don't personally believe that the religion of the 21st century is going to be an institutional universal religion. So it seems to me we're in an age of prophecy, and that it's occurring universally across the planet. And therefore we're in an age of false prophecy as well. So we've got all our, you know, Scientologies and all the things like that as well.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Muktananda quite a bit. intrigued me what you said about him. Have you met him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Could you tell us a little about your feelings about him? Do you think he's a true prophet? And what else?
I think there's a difference between Muktananda and the cultural wrapper around him. He himself is a kind of wild man. He's got an interesting sense of whimsy. He doesn't speak English, so I'm just, you know, picking this up from his body language. Sorry?
From his hat.
From his hat, from his body language, from his manners, from his eyes. He's very clearly an orthodox tantric guru of the kind of Shakti tradition. He has tremendous power. When he does give you Shaktipat, you know, your eyeballs roll up and away you go. So there's no denying him that. Nevertheless, much as I admire the classical lineage, I still feel, I guess, to use Peter Caddy's language again, that he's old age, and that is the guru is Maharaja, and that when he imports it from India to America and sets it up in the way that he has, he takes on all the contradictions both of India and America, and what's created as a cultural religious movement is a very contradictory one. And so I don't see any political prophetic savvy on how to avoid the contradictions of Indian lineage or how to avoid the contradictions of American religious experience and do something more imaginative. When he's not around, it's not as interesting because he has this direct power to give, you know, Shaktipat or direct transmission. I don't think he's a fraud. He's been used by Werner Erhard and Werner Erhard financed his trip to the United States, the guy of EST. And I have some reservations about that whole merchandising of the sacred approach. I'm told by people that I respect that EST is okay. It's for people who can be helped for that kind of thing. But I don't think Muktananda is a fraud. I think he's an orthodox guru, but I think that's limited. And I think the mistake to think that a guru who has that power is unlimited is part of the naivete of American chelas and disciples. They don't realize that a person can go into an impersonal samadhi state and then come out and be a lousy poet, or be dumb, or be a stupid politician, or any of these things. And when a wise man takes on a personality or an external vehicle, he takes on all the noise and crud that the rest of us have. And so the attempt to idealize the guru and imagine that he's somehow, you know, disincarnate and beyond the pale is, I think, naive, politically naive. So I have trouble with, I wouldn't become a follower of Muktananda or join the religion or things of that sort. So I revere him as an authentic person, but I don't find him any more authentic than meeting a great genius physicist like a Heisenberg or a great artist. I used to think when I was younger that there was a straight linear line and that people like Yogananda were at higher levels of evolution than a Whitehead or a Yeats. And you could almost categorize people in a kind of escalator that when they get this far, they're beginning to break off into another higher dimension. And I think that's very naive, and that a very high soul can take on an incarnation as an artist or take on the personality of a Wagner and be a son of a bitch, but for specific reasons. And that this notion that we have got to lie down and die before the East and that somehow or other they're at a higher stage of evolution of consciousness than our scientists or our poets or things of this sort, I don't accept at all.
By their fruits you shall know them, you know? I mean, if you're talking about Wagner, for instance, saying that he's possibility of being a very high soul.
Well, it depends what you mean by their fruits. You know, who was it that said, God save me from my followers? Or, you know, Jung would say, I am not a Jungian, so that you can't, I don't think, directly pin Nazism onto Wagner. You can deal with the problems of Wagner as Wagner and the music dramas, you know, as their own particular limited art form. But the consequences that come later would be like trying to blame the Vietnam War on George Washington or Thomas Jefferson, and that there are, I think the karma is more complicated than that. But I think when one considers by their fruits ye shall know them, and one sees what comes out of a scientist or an artist or a poet, then it's possible, I think, to see that that has a certain value commensurate with these more elevated souls like the gurus or the yogis.
It doesn't seem to me that Whitehead and Einstein were sort of out of a different box from the more psychotic-y type geniuses. An extraordinary warmth.
That's why I guess I like them so much.
And humor and, you know, loving immediate contact with the people they're talking to and all that. Where the Russells and the Newtons and the Descartes were obviously, you know, barely in contact at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think we should think that the prophetic personality is necessarily the pinnacle. This is why in the Moses lecture I kept emphasizing that it had to be the ordinary personality Joshua that goes into the promised land and not the heroic Moses. So that I think there's a stage that I talked about last week where the Roshi becomes more ordinary than the heavy student, and that first there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. And so a Whitehead is a kind of saintly, gentle, calm kind of figure who is beyond the tumult and fury and you know, frothing at the mouth, and is probably in a totally different religious state, maybe even a higher one. The prophet has to interact in history, and that means that you have to swim in mud. What's that?
I don't know about higher and lower and all that, I say.
Right.
But these people are merry.
Have which?
Are merry.
Yeah.
And merriness, I don't think, goes with really being, you know, ashamed.
Isaiah seems to have a quality of joy, of, you know, to use the Yeats's phrase, second Isaiah, of gaiety transfiguring all that dread, that really is sublime and sings and seems to have a humanity more poignant and transcendent by its very ordinariness than the others. And so it seems to me that second Isaiah could be...
Jesus seems to have a certain merriment.
Right, yeah. So Jesus and second Isaiah are very different from Elijah.
Yeah, yeah.
But it wasn't Elijah kind of vengeful?
No accident that John the Baptist got his head cut off, too. Probably that's the karma of that line.
Kind of different from all of the Eastern kind of so-called saints or prophets. Some
reason had
a little more feeling of humanity or compassion.
The relationship between merriment and suffering is interesting. The touch to suffering, like you were talking about in 2nd Isaiah and also in Jesus, and coming out of that awareness of suffering, the merriment is an interesting relationship.
Yeah, joy seems to always have that quality of suffering affirmed and somehow transcended, whether it's Beethoven's 14th string quartet or whatever. And there seems to be in some of the other prophets a brooding fury. And sometimes in clearly psychotic prophets, like, say, Louis Riel, where you've got clear example that this guy is not a second Isaiah, and he's, some of the visions he was having at Mount Vernon and things that he acted upon later are clear examples of a guy who was, you know, having trouble interacting with history and losing touch and the rest of it, and has this kind of paranoid suspicion of everybody around him. And yet there are still things that are fascinating and noble in Louis Riel too. So he's a very complicated, real human being who is a mixture of light and dark and psychosis and inspiration. And that's why he's so kind of fascinating folk hero for Canadians.
Would you comment on the potential evil of prophets? I think you have, in some of your writings, made a very strong point that people who are action-oriented, who are systems-oriented, who promote plans for how people should act and try to carry them out, have built-in evil.
Yeah, I think everything has its shadow. So if there's prophecy, then the shadow of it is that one is always trying to get somewhere else, or one is always locating value in some transcendent state. And so you've got to massacre the multitudes or go off into jihad, or you have to kill humanity for some sublime abstraction. And so it can be dehumanizing and fail to really get one in touch with the simple things that Gregory's talking about in the type of, say, Jesus or Whitehead. And Yeats really talks about this in his poem, Easter 1916, where he's talking about Patrick Pearse and these long-suffering revolutionaries who are trying to lead the country into freedom and liberation and have caught up with all these visionary prophecies of the return of Cathaoirleán, the Irish mythic hero. And he says, too much of suffering can make a stone of the heart. And so he's very much concerned of the oxymoron, the a terrible beauty is born, that there is a beauty to the death of the executed revolutionaries, but it's also a terrible beauty, and that it creates an Ireland in which everybody knows how to die for Ireland, but nobody knows how to live in Ireland. And so Yeats is continually being torn apart by the contradiction about castigating the multitude by saying you've shamed yourself again, or those who fumble in your greasy tills and sell out the nation continually, and he's always attacking the shopkeepers, at the same time that the revolutionaries who are always trying to die for some mythic fantasy can't live in Ireland. They're forever going around, as they're going in Ulster now, playing out the myth of the IRA, you know, revolutionary. So everything has its shadow, and the difficulty is that the devil is the ape of God, and so wherever you have been and have transcended, that will become the incarnation of the evil for that time. So if the messianic thing is consummated, say, with Jesus, then the evil begins to be the Messiah. If Jesus was an archetype of individuation, to use Jung's psychology of Jesus as that archetype, then culture is moving toward hyper-personalization, individuation, and the archetype of the single person, so that the evil of our time then would be the messianic figure, the person who says, I am the Lord of the universe, I am a highly evolved person that can take you into clear state, I am the, you know, the Reverend Moons, the what's the guy?
L. Ron Hubbard.
The Guhu Maharaj-ji, people like that. And if you look at that historically, it's fascinating, because in Trois Frères, there's an image of the god, of the man in animal clothing, of the sorcerer. And then there's in 3000 BC, there's a Neolithic figure that looks like our devil, that has a cloven hoof and kind of pendulant phallus, and is in red. And then in the Neolithic villages of Crete, there are these ithyphallic statues of the sort of the devil with pointed horns. And it's very clear that the old nature divinity, once you move into civilization, becomes the devil. And so once you move into the messianic dispensation, then the devil is the ape of God, and so the Messiah, the Antichrist, becomes the evil. And so now that we're moving into an age beyond religion, what is the evil we're afflicted with? Religion. And so religion becomes to be the embodiment of the demonic. And so there's always that thing, you can't settle in to say religion is good, because history is always moving and you can't lock values into time, so even religion can become demonic. And so prophecy can become delusion, which is what Jesus was saying.